Welcome.
We're discussing the topic, did Jesus rise from the dead? And we're talking with two wonderful guests. Dr. Anthony Flew, considered by many to be the world's foremost contemporary philosophical atheist. And Dr. Gary Habermas, a renowned Christian philosopher and historian, considered by many to be the foremost expert on the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And guys, I just appreciate you being here. We want to jump right to the crux of the matter. Do we have historical evidence to prove that Jesus actually lived? Did he die on a cross? What about the disciples? Did they have experiences which they believed were literal appearances of the risen Jesus? You've got four, Dr. Habermas, that you have said out of the 12 that you presented in our last segment, that all contemporary or all critical scholars would basically agree with these facts. There's a ton of evidence. We need some of that evidence, but first of all, what are the facts?
Well, what I did, John, from this list of 12 facts surrounding the, from, let's say, Friday to Sunday in the life of Jesus traditionally, I've taken four. Now, it's an arbitrary number because, to my knowledge, nobody would give you as few as four. I mean, Rudolf Bultmann probably gives you 20 from this last week, you know, half a week in Jesus' life. But what I've done is I think there are four facts out of the 12 that do three things. First of all, I think that these, a couple other of the 12 facts, but these in particular, you can refute the major naturalistic theories using nothing but the data surrounding these facts. Secondly, you've got the best evidences for the resurrection here. And third, you're doing all of it with a very small kernel of historical data. So you're not requiring the Gospels or this or that. This all comes from Paul.
Okay, what are they? What are the facts?
Well, the first one is that Jesus died due to the rigors of crucifixion. Secondly, that the disciples had experiences that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. Thirdly, their lives were changed. They were transformed. They undeniably believed that Jesus saw them and they turned the world upside down. And fourthly, a man named Paul, as we've discussed, a skeptic, a critic who killed Christians and imprisoned them, came to Christ by an experience that he believed.
All right, now Tony, next to you would be saying that, hey, if you're not a Christian, some of those facts, or Tony, you tell them. Would you agree with all those facts?
Yes, I think I would.
Okay.
These literal appearances, I'm very much a sympathizer of the Thomas who appears very late, really, in the Gospel story, with doubts as to whether there is an actual physical body there. And as far as I can see, there's nothing said to say that he actually did put his hands in and find it. He's told he ought to do, and then it's reported that Jesus is reported as saying that he had seen rather than that he had actually felt the body.
Gary, what do you think?
Well, he tells Thomas to touch him. Tony's right. John does not tell us that Thomas touched him. I would add the following, though. Ignatius, just perhaps 10 years after the Gospel of John, 107 A.D., Ignatius says at that point that Thomas did touch him. Be that as it may, we've got two earlier accounts of women touching Jesus from the Gospels. One is the women as a whole who take Jesus by the ankles in Matthew 28:9. And we've got the case of Mary Magdalene who comes back alone, and she thinks he's the gardener, and she turns around and sees him, and she knows it's him, and he says, "Stop clinging to me." So I get this picture of Mary holding him for all she's worth. So we have the women touching him, Mary touching him, and at least Ignatius says Thomas touched him.
Not only that, but the fact is, if you're going to use the account about Thomas, where I won't believe, okay, you have a skeptic there, I won't believe until I can put my hands right into the nail prints and see the side. Okay, whatever happened, you have his testimony after he said that, "My Lord, my God." So something happened. What do you think?
Well, it is curious that Jesus is reported as saying not, so now you've touched, you believe, and so on. But he was saying that he'd seen. It's a very peculiar thing to my mind. It's not the way that I would have written a report if I'd been here, there, and seen someone actually touching after the...
What about the women? In the two accounts, the women and Mary Magdalene alone, do you think they...
Well, these are accounts that they did. Yes, indeed. But that we have an account that they touched him is not a decisive reason to believe that he was touched. This is what they were reported as having done.
But you'd have more to complain about if no one touched him in the gospel.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
At least we have these three cases, because Ignatius says Thomas touched him.
It's rather remarkably little, actually. After all, we all presumably remember, art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? You know, this is surely the first thing anyone would do if they were wondering whether the vision was a seeing of something that was there that other people could see and touch and so on.
By the way, if you're going to admit the data from the Gospels there, the same author of the fourth Gospel, 1 John, starts out the first three verses and says, we've seen him with our eyes, our hands have touched him, we've beheld the word that, you know, in John 1:14, the word was made flesh. So John comes back in the first epistle, if you like, you know, that material.
Let me read it to you here. Yeah. Six times he says, we have seen something, six times we have heard something, and he says, that which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at, the Greek is scrutinized, and our hands have touched. Mm-hmm. Now, Jesus, in Luke, wasn't it, where Jesus said, touch me and see that I'm not a ghost.
Right. Yes. And eats.
Yeah. So the evidence seems to show that we have a literal physical body going on here that the boys were a little bit surprised to see in the first place, but it took them quite a few experiences, and they did touch, they did see, and that's what they're claiming.
They didn't touch there, sure. They saw a vision of someone eating, didn't they?
Well, he says there, that which we touched.
Well, if you like the straightforward account, in Luke 24, Jesus said, a spirit hath not flesh and bones as ye see me have. So he's saying, I'm not a spirit, if we take the Gospels, straightforwardly.
Well, the spirit is claiming not to be a spirit.
That, since he's saying he's not a spirit, I assume that means he's not a spirit.
Why is it? There are some people, Gary, that would say that, you know, the resurrection is you go into a lot of churches across the country. The minister in that church would say, this is not a physical, literal resurrection of Jesus from the dead. This is what they call a spiritual resurrection from the dead. Why not? Why not just a spiritual resurrection?
Well, this is the earlier point that I was at odds with Tony. I would say today, this is a statement whenever you try to tell us where scholars are today, but I'm currently studying 100 sources on the resurrection from 1975 to 2000 to see if I can get a feel for where critical scholars are. And by far, most scholars today think something really happened. The disciples had real experiences. They believed they saw the risen Jesus. And most of these scholars think the disciples really saw something. They had real experiences. But the majority of scholars who will admit, even some of them think even Jesus appeared there, they shy away from the physical body. And they think, I don't know, these are my words, but maybe some kind of shimmering hologram or something. So that's probably the typical approach today from skeptics that are somewhere in between the two of us.
Another word that people would usually say is, hey, Paul uses the word spiritual in 1 Corinthians 15.
Right.
Does he mean spiritual in the sense of some ethereal kind of wispy kind of see-through thing, or is this a literal physical body? What do the words mean there?
This is crucial for us because we believe that we've been playing around here with the Gospels a little bit, but we would both say Paul is by far the best evidence. He's the only eyewitness, and that's what everybody says today. So what Paul thinks about the resurrection body is crucial. Now, just to note there in 1 Corinthians 15, there's obviously a Greek word for spirit, pneuma. Paul doesn't choose that word. He says spiritual body. So I assume there's some change going on, but the idea is there's a physical body there. Now, to show my earlier comment, I would not think that Paul is saying Jesus appeared as a spirit. And if you want me to give that to you briefly, in a Pauline book accepted by all critics, Philippians, by the way, critics almost always accept Romans, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, and Philippians. G.A. Wells, who's probably to the left of Tony, he accepts eight of Paul. He accepts those five and three others. In Philippians chapter 3,
I'm going to ask you to hold on to those, and we'll take a break, and we'll come right back and hear the reasons why it's not a spiritual resurrection, but a physical resurrection. Hang in there with us. Welcome. We have two guests today that are very special that are debating the topic, did Jesus rise from the dead? They are Dr. Anthony Flew, considered by many to be the world's foremost philosophical atheist, a man who has authored more than 23 books, including Hume's Philosophy of Belief, God in Philosophy, Introduction to Western Philosophy, The Presumption of Atheism, and other philosophical essays on God, freedom, and immortality. My second guest is Dr. Gary Habermas, a renowned Christian philosopher and historian, who's considered to be, by many, the foremost expert on the evidence, the historical evidence, for Jesus' resurrection. Gary's authored 21 books, including The Historical Jesus, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ, In Defense of Miracles, and Why Believe God Exists. Gentlemen, we're glad that you are here. And we are moving on in terms of the case, Dr. Habermas, for Christians believing in the resurrection, the literal, physical, bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, we have talked about hallucination. We've talked about there's 12 historical facts that have been accepted by all critical scholars. And we've even gone down to four. I'd like to come back to a couple of those. One is some people doubt that Jesus actually died on the cross. In other words, Tony brought up at the beginning of the program, we haven't got a date for his birth. We haven't got a date toward the end. What about that? How do we know that Jesus actually died on the cross? Let's start with that. Do we have any other sources outside of the New Testament that nail that one down?
Well, I think on the case of crucifixion, you have data coming in from a variety of angles. First of all, medical data. You have critical data from scholars. You have extra-biblical data in a wide variety. I said earlier that John Dominic Cross and Marcus Bourque, co-founders of the Jesus Seminar, both said that the fact that Jesus was crucified is as sure as any fact in the ancient world, certainly in the life of Christ. Why do they say that? Well, medical facts, real briefly, in a Journal of the American Medical Association article about 15 years ago, and there's many other dozens of medical articles, death by crucifixion is essentially death by asphyxiation. The centurion or any other person standing at a crucifixion does not have to have an EEG or an EKG. If you're hanging low on the cross for any amount of time, studies from volunteers actually show a cutoff point of about 12 minutes. If you're hanging low for any amount of time, you're not faking, you're dead. And you've got the problem of the spear in the side, which is in the Gospel of John, but which is confirmed from two other sources outside the Bible, one Roman, one Christian, that they did these things, that they offered a coup de grace. You've got David Strauss's critique, a famous critique, who said that if Jesus got off the cross and he was alive, you have a horrible problem, because if he shows himself to the disciples, you've got the problem that he's living, but he's not raised. And if they don't believe he's raised, there's no Christianity. Now, that's some of the medicine. I told you about Bourque and Cross. Why do they think that? Well, there's a lot of reasons, and I think they take the Gospels very seriously here. But the extra-biblical data that you asked for, of the 17 extra-biblical non-Christian sources within about 150 years of the life of Jesus, 12 of them, roughly two-thirds, mention the cross and all kinds of details. And also, Paul's our number one scholar here.
Give me a couple of the outside sources.
Outside sources. Tacitus mentions the fact that Jesus died on the cross. He said Pontius Pilate was the Judean procurator. He said that Tiberius was the governor. You have Lucian, the famous satirist, who called him a crucified sophist. You've got Mara Bar Serapion, who tells his son to emulate Jesus, who gave his life, and so on. Josephus, and a passage that, although it's disputed, virtually everybody believes the portion about the cross there, that he died, and Josephus also mentions Tiberius Caesar. So this is all right there. You've got some Gnostic sources that mention these things. You've got Thallus and Phlegon, two scholars that mention that the darkness surrounded the world when Jesus was crucified. So there's a bunch of them. And you've got Paul, that we both consider the best source here. Paul mentions the crucifixion of Jesus on several occasions and says that's his major preaching point.
Okay, the Quran says that Jesus didn't die on the cross. What would you say to those folks?
Well, first of all, the Quran has two passages, one that implies he did die, one that implies he did not die, but I'd say it's beside the point. The Quran is written in the 7th century. That's 6.5 centuries after the cross. I, by historical standards, I find it hard to believe that the Quran has much to contribute to an event that happened 6.5 centuries earlier.
What do you think, Tony?
Well, that's very... the prophet's knowledge of... anything very much, but certainly knowledge of, say, the Old Testament, insofar as it existed in that form, is sketchy, to put it mildly.
And you accept the fact that he died at the cross?
Oh, gosh, yes.
In 1985, 15 years ago, we had a Q&A from the crowd, and one of the students said, they must have taken the wrong impression, but they said, so you believe Jesus didn't die on the cross? And I distinctly remember him calling the swoon theory rubbish.
Yeah. Now, John Dominic Crossan, although he would admit that Christ died on the cross, says he was probably laid over in some trash heap and torn apart by the dogs. He doesn't believe this tomb idea. Now, the tomb in which Jesus was buried, talk about that. What's the evidence?
Yeah, the burial.
Well, okay. First of all, get him buried. Was he buried in a tomb? What's the evidence for that?
Well, the interesting thing about Crossan is very few of his colleagues agree with him here. There's not a bit of evidence, not a bit, that says that Jesus was buried in an unknown plot and chewed up. And there's a lot of data to think that he was. Let's put it this way. The data I'll get to in a second on the empty tomb all argues that he was buried in a separate plot. But there's not any data. And, you know, it's usually the Christians. We often thought of as Christians being put back on their heels saying, where's the data, where's the data? But I wonder where Dr. Crossan says he was buried in a common grave and chewed up by dogs. I think it's real easy. You say, give me one source.
I tell you, are we still on board on this one so far?
Well, I should have thought that this sort of detail is something which we're entirely dependent on the gospel evidence, aren't we? This sort of point.
Are we?
I disagree.
All right. Why?
No. I disagree.
Talk to your buddy there.
Yeah, talk to my buddy.
Yes. All right.
two examples. Acts 13, not the book of Acts, but in Acts there are a lot of creedal passages, small creeds. And in Acts 13, we are told that he was laid in a tomb and God raised him, so we have an empty tomb. Back to our buddy Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, Paul uses a long sentence with what's called a triple hot clause. In the Hebrew, it reads like, the Hebrew thinking, but in the Greek, it reads like this. Paul says, he died for our sins according to the scriptures, he was buried, and that he was buried, and that he was raised, and that he appeared. So if you've got a person who's dead, buried, raised, and appears, it's very hard to imagine that sequence without what going down is what's coming up. So I think Paul's very clear that what went down is what comes up. You've got this and, triple OT clause. He died. He was buried. He was raised. He appeared. And you've got Philippians 3:11 again, ekonostasis, coming out from among the dead. How you can have that combination to be a Pharisee and believe that something comes down is not coming up, I think we do have Paul on the empty tomb.
Yeah, and that goes back. If he wrote it in 55, he preached it in 51, and he got it from Peter in 35. Peter had to get it from someplace, and
That's right.
Said all the boys were preaching the same thing.
Sure. And you got that early text in Acts 13. But this is Paul on the empty tomb. I think we've got a number of other reasons for believing the empty tomb also.
Why do you think that the evidence shows, okay, he was put into the tomb. Why do you think that the tomb was empty on the third day or a few days after Christ died? Let's go the opposite direction.
Why do I think it was empty?
Yeah. In other words, what's the evidence that shows that it was empty?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, why was it empty? And I was going to say, because he's raised.
There you go.
Okay, evidence for the empty tomb. Well, the one hint I just gave is that we do have some early accounts, a creedal passage in Acts 13 and 1 Corinthians 15 on Paul's sequence, but a couple other things. The Jews omitted the empty tomb, and we have three sources, not just Matthew, but we have Justin Martyr and Tertullian. All three tell us that the Jews omitted the tomb was empty. The fact that Jesus died in the same city that the disciples did their earliest preaching, everybody realizes that early Christian preaching happened in Jerusalem. I don't know if there's anybody who disagrees with that. And yet, there's a problem. The city where he died is the city where they began preaching a few days later. If that tomb is full, don't you think somebody would say, fellas, we got a little problem here, this little matter of a body. So, bad place to be preaching. They should have been preaching in Galilee or Rome, but not Jerusalem. So you've got the city of Jerusalem as an evidence. You've got early attestation. You've got the Jews admitting it. And you know there's a critical historical principle. What your enemies admit is usually true. It's called the principle of enemy attestation. And I could throw some others in there too. If Rudolf Bultmann is right, and the New Testament, if the Gospels are Monday morning quarterbacking, reading ideas of 80-ish AD back into the Gospels, you don't pick women as your witnesses. Right. And I don't want to offend people in the crowd here, but in the first century, a woman could not testify in a court of law. Jewish writings said women are liars. And the interesting thing is, Luke 24:11, when the women come back from the tomb and tell the disciples, Luke 24:11, they thought they were spreading gossip. They thought they were spreading tales. So if I'm writing this story and retrojecting it back from 80-ish A.D. to 30 A.D., I don't pick women as my prime witnesses. So there's another big problem. Those are just some of the evidences for the tomb. You've got the women, you've got early attestation by Paul, you've got the Jews admitting it, and Jerusalem is the city. That's a big no-no. You don't preach in the city where the body's in the tomb. There's four that I'd let Tony respond to.
All right, we're going to take a break, and Tony, when we come back, we'll let you respond. Stick with us. All right, we're back, and we're talking with two wonderful guests on the topic, Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? We're talking with Dr. Anthony Flew, considered by many to be the world's foremost philosophical atheist, and Dr. Gary Habermas, a renowned Christian philosopher and historian, considered by many to be the foremost expert on the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. It's a fascinating discussion and a crucial discussion. And Tony, I want to know, what do you think about this evidence that Dr. Habermas just presented on the empty tomb? Do you go along with it?
I don't think you should be apologetic about this at all. These facts are facts, and I could rather wish that in these topics more people were prepared to face facts rather than run away and say, we mustn't say that. No, this is a very impressive piece of argument, I think.
So you accept the empty tomb?
Well, I think this is an impressive testimony.
Thank you.
It's very difficult to get round this.
But then now, it seems earlier, this has occurred to me, if the tomb is empty, what does that say to hallucination? Because hallucination requires the body being the tomb.
Well, yeah, the first question is, what happened to the body?
That's your question.
Well, we have no independent witnesses, there are all sorts of ways of removing bodies. You know, I'm not going to offer a theory to me because I simply don't think one can reconstruct a story of what happened in a city all that long ago when we haven't got the sort of evidence that one might have today with the invention of cameras and all the rest of it.
All right, now Gary, in your book, let's stop right there, and I'll give a plug to your book, The Historical Jesus. All right.
Okay.
You've got a whole chapter on how Tony's friends, other naturalists, shot themselves in the foot by proposing all kinds of different ideas for what happened to the body.
Right.
Roll through it quickly in 2 minutes. Hit some of the high spots.
Well, we've talked about several. Some people say Jesus didn't die on the cross, although there's virtually no scholar out there who says it today. But if someone thinks Jesus didn't die on the cross, you've got the medical data, you've got to go with Paul, you have the extra-biblical evidence, you've got the Gospels, you've got a lot of things. You asked him earlier, did the disciples lie? Of course, some people think, and he said no. Some people think the disciples stole the body and then lied about the appearances. It doesn't work because they were transformed, they died, most of them died for what they believed to be true. We've talked about hallucination, and that's an important theory because it's the one he holds. Some have said the whole thing is a legend, but the problem with the legend, one of the main problems is that you've got a man like Paul that we have early data, and for legend theory to be true, you want to probably get that out of the hands of the eyewitnesses and removed a little bit past. I mean, for example, our two best biographies of Alexander the Great are not written for 3 to 4 centuries after Alexander. And it's after that time that mythology starts creeping in. Miraculous stories about Alexander, which, by the way, are post-Christian. They come after Christ. And he lived in the 4th century B.C. So for legend, when you've got early eyewitnesses, that's a real problem. So I think this data can respond with 6 or 8 refutations of every naturalistic theory. But I think that's important because the one that's been on the table tonight is hallucination. And I think the empty tomb is one more huge problem because now Tony has to have two of these theories. He's got to have hallucination. Well, actually, he's got to have three. He's got to have one kind of hallucination for Paul, one kind of hallucination for the disciples. That's what he chooses. And now he's got a problem with the body in the tomb. Now, he's right. Bodies vacate tombs for different reasons. However, he's got to have the body vacating the tomb happening simultaneously with the disciples seeing the appearances. And, of course, he's got Paul later. So now he's starting to pile up these theories. And I think the more improbable theories you have, you could have a highly probable...
Didn't he write an article on that somewhere along the line?
Somewhere.
No, I'm not offering a naturalistic account of what happened. I'm not trying... I don't think it's possible to offer any satisfactory naturalistic account of what...
Except for hallucination theories.
But I do think hallucination covers a lot of the data, but I don't offer anything to cover the empty tomb evidence.
Tony, do you think that do you believe in group hallucinations?
I don't see it's necessary to rule this out, but I think it's important to make a distinction that doesn't seem to have been made in the Gospels between a group of people seeing something severally and them seeing it together. Statements that these things were afterwards seen by the 12. This is not a categorical statement that they were all together when they had the experience.
What do you think, Gary?
I think Tony's getting himself in a lot of hot water. Number one, he's got an empty tomb with no cause ventured for the tomb.
Nice.
Secondly, he's got hallucinations for the disciples that don't work for the half dozen reasons I gave earlier. Groups don't see hallucinations. They weren't in the right frame of mind. You have different times, places, people, gender, doing different things. The empty tomb... It doesn't transform lives, change Paul, all reasons. Hallucinations are pretty rare. I tell you the conditions under which they occur. Bodily deprivation, or when someone's taking drugs, and these aren't the conditions of the disciples. So he says no group hallucinations, but 10 or 20 people are having their own hallucinations without medical warrant. But he's going to have everybody having them. I think that's. I just think it's a real issue.
All these things I've got to do if I was going to offer what I don't believe is possible for anyone to offer, a full naturalistic account of what was going on there.
You're doing a good job because he's got single hallucinations to everybody.
Another thing that I've noted in the last 15 years is that the. Are one or two very spectacular cases of mass hallucinations. The supposed miracle of Fatima,
Or Medjugorje?
Not many people were involved. How many?
Yugoslavia.
Yes, well, how many were involved?
Tens of thousands.
But
the only problem with these, and with Fatima, where people come with the so-called apparitions of Mary, it's exactly the opposite of what the disciples are seeing. Because people go to Lourdes or to Fatima or to Medjugorje. You've got 10,000 people watching the children watch Mary. The only problem is the 10,000 people in the crowd don't see anything except they see signs in the heavens, but they don't see Mary. Of course, they don't see Jesus. So,
but the hallucination is seeing the ongoings in the heavens. Right?
That's an illusion, though, not an hallucination. If you're going to report that the sun is moving, remember Kent's differentiation between an illusion and hallucination?
Well,
an illusion is when you see something and think it's something else. An hallucination is when there's no objective referent. And so the people standing there in Medjugorje, they say they see signs in the heavens, but after all, there are stars, there are trees, there are mountains, there are sun. I mean, what they say is the sun was moving and the stars were moving, but it really is the sun and stars. That's far different from saying they saw Mary. I mean, my point is that in Medjugorje, 99.9% of the people do not see Mary.
Well, no.
But with the disciples, you've got the whole group seeing Jesus. So I just don't think it's an analogy. I think there's a real problem there using that. And I definitely don't think it's a mass hallucination because it may be a mass illusion. But illusion, once again, an illusion is when you see something, water on the highway, or take your hat off and put it on your bed at night and wake up and think someone's standing in your room, or a magician. Those are illusions. But hallucination is a much more radical concept. And hence what I'm saying, when he says 12 or 15 or 20 people have to have individual hallucinations, this is very radical, very tough to prove.
Okay, over the 15 years Tony's been thinking about this, you've been thinking about Tony, haven't you?
Yes, I have been thinking about Tony.
What would you like to say to him?
No, in a real special sort of way, because, folks, I dialogue with a lot of atheists, a lot of skeptics. I've had 2- and 3- and 5-year correspondence. I've had 8-year correspondence right now with an agnostic. But Tony, I'm saying this sincerely, Tony is the kindest, most moral, most sincere, I'm serious, atheist that I know. And we've been friends for 15 years. I have photographs in 1985 of my 2-year-old daughter sitting on his knee. He would not let her go to bed till he gave her a goodnight kiss. She's 17 years old. We still have those photos before and after. I mean, he's a good guy. But I've also been praying for him for 15 years. Tony, nothing's impossible, buddy.
Look, at some stage, could we go back to St. Paul?
That's great.
As I understand it, what happened on the road to Damascus was that he had an experience,
right.
And nothing except appeared to his companions other than possibly they heard a voice.
All right, we're going to hold it right there. That'll be our question that we'll start off the next program with, and so join us. We'll be right back. Welcome. We're talking with two world-class philosophers here, and I think everybody that's taken a graduate course in philosophy, they know Dr. Anthony Flew. He's one of the world's foremost philosophical atheists. And Dr. Gary Habermas, a renowned Christian philosopher and historian, considered by many to be the foremost expert on the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And we're talking about the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? And what's the evidence? Is there any evidence? And one of the key things, gentlemen, that we've got to talk about is what did happen to this fella by the name of Paul that was out there killing Christians, going after them, wasn't in the frame of mind to believe, didn't want to believe, thought they were dead wrong, and all of a sudden he became one of the greatest propagators of the Christian faith. Now, something happened. Tony, talk to me. What do you think happened to Paul?
The account seems to be that he had some companions, the people who later, after he'd fortunately temporarily lost his sight and took him on into Damascus, and he thought that the risen Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, he'd seen this, and the Messiah had talked to him. But his companions, apparently, at most, on some accounts he heard a voice and some they didn't. But they certainly are not said to have seen something that you could push around on any sort of ordinary or even abnormal human body.
All right, so Gary, what do you say to your buddy?
Well, again, I think the main problem with Paul, he's right. The crux of the data is that we have Paul himself on several occasions, 1 Corinthians 9:1, 1 Corinthians 15:8, Galatians 1, saying he saw Jesus. But if he's not, I don't think he's a candidate for Kant's theory, not a candidate for conversion disorder, because like I said, conversion disorder does not involve hallucination. So Paul would have to have a conversion disorder. Number two, an auditory hallucination, because he thought he heard a voice. Three, a visual hallucination. Four, and then Messiah complex, visions of grandeur, so to speak, because he believed God spoke to him and gave him a message for the whole world. And five, there's not one speck of evidence from Paul's account that he was in the mood to be changed, why he would want to change. So it seems to me we have four psychological problems, and then a biblical problem from Paul's writing. I'm wondering how you can change a conversion disorder of Kant, your theory, how you can combine a conversion disorder with a visual hallucination, with an auditory hallucination, with visions of grandeur, Messiah complex.
Most of this, I'm not trying to offer a naturalistic or any other explanation of that. I want to know what the alleged phenomena are him.
But that is a naturalistic theory.
No, it is a possible one. It may be something wrong with that. I don't profess to be a psychological expert who knows what a conversion order is. I've read Werner William James and so on. And
I mean,
heard
about two big, one of Kent's two big thrusts that Paul had. I'm just saying it doesn't even follow. Even if he had a conversion disorder, it doesn't follow that he would see, hear, and think God gave him a message.
These are reasons for not accepting conversion order as an explanation. I'm not particularly worried about that. I mean, I read this in
Kent.
What I want to raise is what it was that Paul actually saw. What he thought he saw was the risen Christ, but what was there to be seen? And his companions apparently didn't see the risen Christ or anything else other than Paul obviously having some very important transforming experience.
You do know from the, if you take the three texts in Acts,
yes.
Acts 9, 22 and 26, they did see a light, the companions
yes.
did see a light. They all fell down on their knees.
Yes.
They heard a voice, but they didn't understand what the voice was saying. So it's I don't want this to go. I don't want people to get the idea that what I'm agreeing with you on is that they were just standing there and they saw nothing. They saw light. They heard a voice. They fell down to the ground. So plainly, there's an objective effect on them too, which, by the way, is an additional problem for conversion disorder.
Oh, yeah.
Because if Paul has a conversion disorder, how come his companions are falling down to the ground, seeing a light, and hearing a voice?
Okay. I never professed to be a psychological expert. Okay, conversion order, but still, in order to have something that is going to transform your life, and this is, of course, we're entirely agreed, this is absolutely crucial about
this. Right.
But unless there was something there that the television cameras could have picked up and all that,
right.
We don't have any reason for thinking that, other than if we already have reasons for believing that God's going to communicate with Paul.
You've got Philippians 3. You've got those three arguments in Philippians 3 that Paul thought this was a physical body.
Yeah, okay, he thought that.
That's
but,
right.
The fact that he thought that is not a reason
that's
decisive for saying that it was there.
Yes, but I mean, when you said Paul believed in a spiritual, sort of almost a ghosty appearance of Jesus, Paul's very clear that what appeared is a body. So he must have thought he saw a body. And you still have like the Acts accounts, you still have those three companions falling down, seeing a light, and hearing a voice. And that's not conversion. Did you say, are you giving up the conversion disorder?
Okay, I'm quite happy to give it up.
Okay.
I've never really been devoted to this. I take it in Kent. He gives me the cycle. The thing I want to maintain is that there wasn't anything there to be seen.
Well, if you don't
how he came to have that, this is the business of psychologists, which, thankfully, I'm not one.
If it's not a conversion disorder, I'll just turn the question around to you. If it's not a conversion disorder and he did not see Jesus, then what did he and his companions see? Why did they all fall down together? What happened on the way to Damascus? If it's not an hallucination and it's not a resurrection, what is it?
If it wasn't visible to his companions, then it can't have been a physical body.
Who said it wasn't visible to the companions? I mean, they see a light, they fall down, they hear a voice.
That's all we're told
about. Let's put this way.
See a light fall
philosophically, as you know, a contradiction. Two things cannot both be and not be, same time, same place, same matter. We're told what they saw, but we're not told what they didn't see. There could have been a physical body standing right there. We're not told there was no body. The text nowhere says there was no body here. And then in Philippians 3, Paul says he's a body. The only deity we have is Paul's, right? We don't have any companions.
Yeah.
We only have Paul's, and Paul seems to think it was a physical body. So at least, here's the problem. One of our four facts, Paul believes he saw an appearance of the risen Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, it's not an hallucination. Where do we go?
This is what virtually all the people in the Gospels who saw the risen Christ seem to have thought, the only cases of them actually poking and so on and trying to see whether it was tangible are a very small group compared with all the others.
But, all right, let's hold on. Let's talk about that other small group when we come right back.
Yeah.
What about the others that we're mentioning? What happened to them? We'll talk about it in just a moment. Welcome. We're talking with Dr. Gary Habermas and Dr. Anthony Flew. And Gary, what other evidence would you bring into this picture in terms of those that are naturalists that say there's got to be a naturalistic explanation? Tony doesn't seem to know how to explain this stuff. The evidence, the historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection that you've presented so far, but his concern is, hey, just in the ordinary experience of things, it couldn't happen. Now, what would you say to that?
Yeah, the other way I said, one is just overpowering evidence for the resurrection, but the other way to go after it is to say, this world admits other exceptions. Now, near-death experiences, to give you an example, would not be a miracle. However, if near-death experiences evidence of afterlife, Jesus' resurrection would still be unique. But if people are living after death, now that makes you take a whole new look at the resurrection. So my interest in near-death experiences is not the tens of thousands, if Gallup is right, almost 8 million Americans that have had near-death experiences. My interest is not the tunnels and the lights, because that could be temporal lobe, it could be lack of oxygen. To me, since 1972, I've collected almost 100 cases of near-death experiences where something evidential happens 2 blocks, or in some cases 2 miles away. Now, if I just give one example, this is a real recent one, but the medical doctor, a cardiologist, said in his Michael Sabom, in his 1982 book, Recollections of Death, A Medical Perspective, he said, when I wrote that book, we only had near-death experiences. Now we have post-death experiences. In his most recent book called Light and Death, he gives the case of a southern mother in her 30s who had a brain aneurysm. And they had to fly her out to Arizona for a special technique. And I'm given to believe, it seems like only one doctor in the world does this, but it took 30 doctors and technicians in the room. And what happens is he opened up her skull, and if the aneurysm is right there, you repair it. But if it goes down deep, they put into effect what they call Operation Standstill. And this is crazy because they basically killed their patient. Now, this lady went out to Arizona. He cut open her skull, went down and found this thing is way too deep. So they had to kill her. And what they did was cool her body temperature down to 59 degrees, get all the blood out of her head. They stopped her heart. They stopped her brain. These were stopped for hours. And he's doing his work, and to make a long story short, if you're interested in the end result, he got the vessel, he repaired it, and she is doing fine today. Okay. But what the interesting thing is, in her testimony, when she heard the saw turn on, she said she was out of her body, and as it were, looking over his shoulder at the top of her head. Now, she's getting near to this point where they're going to kill her, and she gives 6 points of corroboration. And one of the things she says is, she said, I had this idea of a drill looking like a pizza cutter or something, but she said it looked like a pen with a little tiny, where'd you get that? And she said, you had a socket wrench next to you. And the medical doctor said, what do you mean socket wrench? And he's, wanting her to give evidence. He said, well, there's this a box that sat open with all these interchangeable parts. He said, draw me a picture of the drill. She drew it. Draw me a picture of the socket set. She drew it. And then she tells things that went out of the room. They couldn't find her artery. They had to go to the other side. She identified which doctor made the decision, which doctor couldn't find the artery. It's in her medical report. But during the experience, and then they kill her. I mean, she's dead for 3 hours. And she has all these points of memory. And I could go on and give others, but in one other case, real briefly, a girl who was drowned, she was underwater for 19 minutes. She reported what her parents were doing at home that night, what her mom did for dinner, where her dad was sitting, a G.I. Joe that her brother played with, a doll that her sister played with. She talked about a popular song that came on the television, in the radio. And she gave this, she was no brain activity, comatose. She came to 3 days later, looked up and told the doctor, you're the one that resuscitated me, told him this big long story, and he checked the data from just 3 days earlier. I think these are some hard cases, and there's dozens of others like them. Now, if this is true, and there's life after death, this isn't Jesus, But if there's life after death, it allows us to understand a model for what we call resurrection.
Tony?
This is supposed to show life after death, is it?
Well, I think, not extenuated life, not heaven, hell, but what I would argue is minimalistic life after death. By minimalistic life after death, I mean minutes, sometimes hours, minutes after cessation of heart or brain waves. Now, to me, if a person's recording something, if it's in my medical report that I flatlined at 3:02, and I had no brain wave at 3:15, and I report something that happened a few minutes after that, or an hour later, and I can tell you what went on, say a police report, and it's after the event. No, I don't think life after death in the traditional view of heaven and hell, but in the sense of having data from minutes after death. And I would think life after hours of death would be tough for a naturalist.
Tony, does that open up the door in terms of the possibility of more than naturalism?
Not really, I think, but this is another subject. It's one of my favorite subjects, actually. I've written a lot of the literature about
the impossibility of
a future life.
What would you say happened in terms of those cases, then, naturalistically?
Somebody have to report something miles away when they have no heart or brain activity.
I mean, this is the sort of thing that's normally called out-of-the-body experiences, isn't it?
Except in an OBE, the person's not anywhere close to death. In an NDE, they're close to death. In the case of this lady from Alabama, I think, or Georgia, she's post-death by all accepted standards. 59 degrees, blood, no blood in the head, no heart, no brain for hours. She shouldn't be reporting anything, should she?
But if she was really dead, she shouldn't be recovering in this way.
This is intriguing evidence for somebody who has no brain activity. She was on a lung machine. Yeah. By the way, her doctor gave her a 10% chance of living and a 1 in 10,000 chance of living without her faculties. 3 days later, she comes to spontaneously and says, "You're the guy that resuscitated me. Where's the tall guy without the beard?" He said, "I'll get him for you." Now, this guy's an agnostic, and I've talked to the doctor myself. Guess what? He's no longer an agnostic. He's a theist. He's not a Christian, but he's a theist. So, it's evidence for something.
Yes, I mean, this is the sort of thing that societies for psychical research, or nowadays it's called parapsychology, investigate. And it seems to me one begins to start talking about psychokinesis, extrasensory perception, and so on.
But you don't believe it. You don't believe in ESP.
No.
Okay, what does a naturalist do with reports from miles away when there's no brain and heart activity?
I don't know about this one. I know what to do with most ESP reports, because basically people again and again try to establish evidence for this. And the only way that will demonstrate this is a repeatable demonstration.
But of course, all these people have functioning brains and hearts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this
so again,
is
a person with
no
brain and heart, this is...
Oh, no. This is a new one to me. Yes.
Okay. This
is certainly a new one.
All right, we have to wrap this up. Gary, in terms of all that we've been talking about, fit near-death experiences in, where does it fit? What is the evidence showing you so far?
Well, what I'm saying is something we haven't even talked about. But Christians want to talk about a theistic worldview. As Tony said, it's not just God out there. It's the God of the Old Testament. There's a whole tradition here. So if we've got good arguments for God's existence, if we have evidence for God writing Scripture, if we have evidence for Him acting in time, if Jesus does miracles, then He rises from the dead. And if today we see cases of double-blind experiments where we can't answer, a medical journal publishes answers to prayer, where 21 out of 26 categories, the person is statistically better. We see some healing examples, which I wish we had time to go into, near-death experiences, and then we talk about the evidence for the resurrection. I think the Christian's point is the resurrection is not isolated. It's part of a big picture, what we would want to call a theistic worldview. It's part of a big picture. And in that picture, the fact that God raised Jesus is extraordinary. It's one of a kind. It shows Jesus is who He said He is. But He's alive. God's working in other ways in the world, too.
All right, please stay with us. You won't want to miss what's coming next. We're going to have questions from the audience, so hang in there.